Fortunately for me, this isn't my first time talking to law students. And if you took all of the people in the room, I've hired more than this many over the course of my career as well. I managed the legal intern program at Intel. And over the course of that, at one time I had a team of as many as, I think 28 is what it maxed out at whenever I left, 28 law students. We would try to pick them up when they were 2Ls at the start of that and get them to work part-time. And by the time they were through with law school, they had, chances are they'd actually done quite a bit of IP work, prep, claim charts, analysis, portfolio mining, so on and so forth. It was an incredible program. And fortunately for me, many of them now are at law firms all over the country, and some of them are even making partner now and so on, and it's pretty exciting to see that. In addition to that, about four of them work for me. So it's always a lot of fun. Let's talk. Who am I? You know, wonderful. Made me sound really good. I appreciate that. I have done a lot of fun stuff, but who am I? Where did I start? I grew up just a little ways down I-64, okay, in that portion of Virginia that Virginia didn't want. They call it West Virginia now. Constitutionally, I think it's the only truly illegal state because it was wholly formed out of Virginia. But at the time, Virginia didn't think it was part of the United States, so they've sort of let it slide, especially since afterwards Virginia said, no way, we don't want it back. So I loved it, and it was really interesting. I didn't realize what the rest of the world was like. My parents brought me home from the hospital to a log cabin. It had a concrete floor. It had a hand pump in the kitchen. And beehive in one of the hollowed out logs. And later on we moved up to a trailer and we had just about the best home in the neighborhood. And I found that really interesting because when I go back there now and like I take my kids and so on and they say, did you really grow up here? And I'm like, this was the most fun I ever had in my life. It really was. I had freedom. I'd roam the countryside and so on. So last night when we landed, coming in, driving over, I was like, wow, this looks and feels like home again. It really does. Of course, till I got to the big city here. But it's really always wonderful to come back. I talked to my father yesterday, and he was very happy about the balmy spring weather, as he called it, because it was getting into the 40s now. I guess it's been pretty rough. I've been fortunate, very fortunate in my life. One of the things that I decided to do towards the end of a bachelor's degree was I picked a project that nobody was working on and people were trying to solve the problem, and that was called image compression. And this was in the mid-80s. And myself and a couple buddies, we decided that we would attempt to try to mathematically model the way a human retina disassembles an image, that there's actually a quantum effect and so on, and if we could figure out how to model that in a way that would throw away information that the eye didn't care about. And lo and behold, it worked. It actually produced some pretty cool looking images and, you know, a fraction, 1/50th, 1/60th, even 1/100th of the space of previously storing the image. So we, not knowing much about business or anything like that, we went out, got some funding, filed a couple patents, and went on the road to try to introduce to the world this wonderful idea. And they looked at me and they said, why do you want to put pictures in computers? We didn't even call it imaging back then. You know, pictures are for televisions and photo albums and so on. You know, computers are monochrome. Most of them were at the time. And it was fascinating to me because, I mean, I could see it plain as day. I could see a half a decade in the future that computers were going to be almost indistinguishable from televisions. But they were scared. They were scared that what they knew, computers as they knew it, would be displaced. So that's sort of how I got into this whole invention thing. And wow, it's been an incredible ride ever since. In the course of doing this, I ran into some people, I did a startup company. I don't even have the logo on here because it doesn't even exist anymore. But I ran into some other people. They were saying, hey, the American National Standards Institute's getting together. Are these thinking about forming a committee? So I started going to those committee meetings. And just a short time later, I found myself chairman of the JPEG committee about 2.5 years after I got my bachelor's degree. Okay? And that was like sort of, whoa. And I mean, they had chief researchers and so on from IBM and all kinds of places. But the thing was, I was the good political choice because I wasn't from a big company. Okay? And so therefore, they felt, a lot of them thought they could boss me around, but that's because they didn't know me. But JPEG wound up being probably still one of the most successful standards in history. It's affected everything that you guys do on a daily basis. Every time you touch a computer now, you're making use of what less than 24 people put together. And from all over the world. I learned a lot during that time. I learned what Mexican food tastes like in about 20 different countries. It wasn't all good. I also learned a lot about dealing with other cultures, convincing people, driving for consensus, and all those wonderful things that most people never get the experience in any time in their career. So then we spun off something from JPEG. It was called MPEG. And you guys, if you're watching TV, it was supposed to happen here soon, but I guess we've put it off till June now. But pretty soon all TV will be transmitted using MPEG. And that's fascinating to me. I mean, it's what we thought would happen. But, you know, I feel like going back to those guys at those other companies saying, see, come on. But my goal was always to try to be a part of creating what I call disruptive technologies. In a classroom, disruptive can be bad. But there's a lot of places where it's not. Disruptive is really cool. And trust me, it can be really, really fun. These are some of the things that I worked on. H323 is now internet video conferencing. If any of you do use your instant messaging engine or something and do pictures or whatever, that's what you're using. And I wrote three of the 12 annexes for H323. HDTV, I was the chief architect for the first nationwide digital television broadcast trial. It was done with PBS and NBC in 1997. That's when we did the first digital television broadcast. And that, the results of that, the architecture of that, became what was known as the Grand Alliance and is now the basis of ATSC, which is the standard by which people broadcast with. So, who am I? I'm just somebody who's been really, really fortunate and has worked really hard. As I was leaving the hotel today, the lady said, don't work too hard. And I said, you should have told me that 20 years ago. Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about patent licensing, and I don't want to go, I'm going to give a lot of you the basics and so on. Most of you hopefully know what a patent is. Some of you may not, okay? But it's constitutionally based, right? You're familiar with this. And it's a contract, basically, between the government and the inventor for the purposes of promoting innovation. If you tell me how to build it, I'll let you have exclusive rights to it for a limited period of time. Now, limited time, that's actually defined by law, and exclusive right is also defined by law. Okay? Right now, timing 20 years from the filing date, but there's some exceptions to that if it was filed before 1995 and, you know, that sort of thing. Or if there's a terminal disclaimer or if the patent office took too long and so on. So at the end of the day, you can get your friendly patent attorney to help you determine what the real priority date and the real expiration date of a patent is. 14 years from issuance on a design patent, that's actually really easy to figure out. Okay. So, it's a property right, and a lot of people, even though you've heard that before, this is one of the things that I found fascinating, is it really is a property right. It has a chain of title. It can be sold, rented. It can have liens on it. People really have liens on their patents. I buy patents from people, and they have a lien from the bank on their patent. And I tell them they have to satisfy that lien or certify they're going to satisfy that lien. Or in some cases, we have to pay it off before we can buy the patent. But and there's things called security interests and on and on and on. It's really interesting. We have in our company now an entire group of people that is effectively the title company for patents. There's 50 people that do nothing day in and day out but title search and clearance on patents. That's interesting, but it makes sense. It's a property right. And so that's something that a lot of people don't think about when they think about buying assets of this type. It also has been the subject of some real stupid moves in the world of patent investing. Okay, people, like major CEOs, have lost their job because they invested $60 million for a set of patents when we had only offered $10 million because we knew it was already licensed to some people and there were some problems with the chain of title and so on. But due diligence is what we call that, and it's really interesting. Now, if you think of property, you own a piece of land, maybe, and you get to use your land. Now, of course, there can be laws in the local community and stuff like that, but a patent is like putting a fence around it and no trespassing signs. Nobody can come on this land, nobody can use it unless they get some pass from you, okay? So you exclude others from use. But it's very different from land in other respects, okay? Exclusion, by the way, has a definition as well by statute. It's making, using, selling, offering for sale, or importing the invention. Did you know even if you had it made in a factory in Singapore and are selling it to a system integrator in China, if you negotiate the contract in the United States, you're infringing the patent because you're selling it in the United States. Now, that's something people don't even think about. But the good news is that, you know, it gives us opportunity to have a more powerful patent if the companies do a lot of the negotiation here. But otherwise, if it's made in Singapore and shipped to China and they transact it, the deal in Amsterdam, and you don't have a patent in either Singapore or China or the Netherlands, then guess what? Too bad. It's doesn't need a license. So there's a patent paradox that is also fascinating to me, because I had patents on image compression, but what I didn't realize is I couldn't make an image compression device because it involved memory, it involved processors, it involved all kinds of things that I didn't have patents for, and I didn't have any way to trade with the companies that had those. So, and I was, not even tactfully reminded of that in one particular instance, okay? That one of the companies told me that, you know, what are you going to do, build these things yourself? No, you're not going to, because you'll have to talk to our patent attorneys if you do that. So it was interesting that you can have a patent on something and that doesn't mean you can ever build it or you can ever make it. So that's a patent paradox. It's a right to exclude, not a right to build. Okay. A third party would, in that case, have a dominating patent on a portion of the invention. Okay, there's patentability tests, useful, novelty, non-obvious, and those are defined by statute and very often rearranged by the courts. Okay, what exactly do they mean by usefulness is usually the lowest bar. In fact, they say it has to serve some purpose. For chemical compounds, they go outside, they pour it on the ground. If it kills the grass, it's a weed killer. If the grass grows, it's a fertilizer. Okay, it's pretty much, makes it useful. Then they can get a chemical, patent on the chemical compound. Novelty is also, believe it or not, not that difficult of a bar. I find it an easy one to get over in many cases. You just have to find the right set of limitations, and it has to be something that hasn't been described before. Now, they've tried to make it more difficult with recent court rulings. If you guys study KSR, KSR is a real interesting case, and I still don't think we understand all the implications of KSR. Because I'm seeing re-exams come back out of the patent office that, you know, one would question whether, according to how intense you want to interpret KSR. it may or may not be valid still. Here's an interesting thing that we're watching really closely, and I mentioned it to Mario yesterday, is that the BPAI, which is the people that you go and push on when they tell you you can't get a patent, and you keep pushing and pushing till you get to the Board of Appeals and you have examiner interviews and on and on and on. But if the examiner says no way, then you go here. Well, they've been denying a lot of patent applications based on case law. And in fact, it's two different cases. It's Kaminsky and Bilski in combination with Kaminsky. And many people, and I think the Fed Circuit included, believes that they sort of are not getting it right. Because part of the problem here was in the Kaminsky decision, they talked about a patent that was not to be issued. And I think it was interpreted that it was not patentable subject matter. Now, what does that mean? There's certain things that are not patentable because they're not made by man. Things like the number pi, or the fact that 1 plus 1 equals 2, or things like that. Those are not patentable because they're not created by man. They're basically laws and principles. And even sophisticated algorithms in and of themselves are not patentable. The implementation of that algorithm in some efficient way or taking little shortcuts that aren't noticeable, whatever, that's very patentable. But at the end of the day, they're starting to throw out all kinds of things. They're throwing out, I could tell you some. They're throwing out signal claims, like where an electronic signal is being created and it has a certain characteristic. It's measurable, it's interpretable, and so on. But they're throwing it out, saying, "Oh no, that's natural. That's not made by man. What it was coming out of an antenna." But nevertheless, so the Fed Circuit has recently given a new decision. And for those of you that are interested in these things, as you can tell, I sometimes get excited about it. I invite you to take a look. Okay. One thing, I apologize in advance for bad jokes. I'm an engineer, and those of you that have friends or that are engineers, you know what I mean. And my wife called me last night and said, don't be too egotistical, don't come across, like you know everything, and so on and so forth. And I said, but honey, I'm in the town where it's okay to be cavalier. Yeah, she groaned too. The other thing is because I grew up down the street, you have to forgive me when my accent comes back in. But it will come back in, despite years of taking Latin? Yeah. Anyway, here's the basics. This is the first U.S. patent. The first U.S. patent was issued to Samuel Hopkins, and it was method of producing potash and pearl ash. And there it is. That's what it looks like, July 31st, 1790. How many of y'all knew that? Yeah, okay, let's see what else you know. Who is the only U.S. patent to hold, only president to hold a patent? Wrong. Who? He says Lincoln. What do you think? He wins the prize. Abraham Lincoln, and it was a boat, basically a hull design. Who was the first patent commissioner? It was a startup. The U.S. was a startup back then. People did all kinds of things. They had worn multiple hats and so on. So who knows who the first patent commissioner was? It's Thomas Jefferson. Okay? Who was his chief patent examiner? Franklin. It was pretty interesting. Franklin did many inventions, including the Franklin stove, but he said, oh no, I'm not getting a patent on that. I'm giving it to the world. He didn't want to build them, is what. Can inventions be valuable? Who wants to guess? How much are these guys worth? Stanford PhDs. They created. What did they create? Who knows? Google. Okay, we all know that. Do they have a Google of money? All right. Times have been tough. They've lost about $3 billion each lately, but they're still worth $16 billion a piece. And that was taken from the Forbes in September. There was an update to it in January. I think this is the updated number from January. I apologize. The September number was 18. So they've lost a couple, in just that short period of time, they've lost a couple billion dollars. Here's a funny story. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, okay? And we have this, the Ames Research Center and Moffett Field and all that stuff there that's owned by NASA. Okay, they have big, giant hangars for blimps. And they've used them and they've created wind tunnels and all kinds of things in there. And it is right in the heart of the peninsula, right by Palo Alto, right there. And for the longest time, all these guys with their jets, their Learjets and stuff, they wanted to land there because it's, you know, it's right there. And they kept saying, no, this is a government facility. A lot of what we're doing here is research. We can't allow the use of it. Well, guess what happened? You got to use the Palo Alto Municipal Airport, which is fine for most of the jets, the Gulfstreams and the Cessnas and the, you know, those sort of things. What kind of jet you think these guys bought? 767. No stinking little Gulfstream for them. We bought our own 767. What was the problem? Runway was too short in Palo Alto. Guess what? Moffett Field's being used by commercial people now. The Google Jet or the Page Bryn Jet lands there all the time, and it's kind of funny, but that's a funny story. Obviously, being that wealthy of a person can make things happen. Okay, so why do we get patents? There's the motivation usually is some sort of related to cost, money, whatever. Companies do it to build value, and there's different types of value that they look for. Defensive value, which is they use to defend themselves. They have a stack of patents, and very often that stack of patents don't even relate to products they build. It relates to products that other people build. Other people that probably have patents on their products. And that way, when somebody knocks on the door, they can start to talk about a trade. The other is offensive value. They patent their core products to keep people out of their space. I mean, you've heard a lot about companies suing each other because so-and-so, the most visible, really stupid move case in that regard was Kodak going into the Instant Camera business. They built, I think it was, I don't know at the time, in today's money it would be about $1.5 billion of a manufacturing facility, engine, and so forth, employed in the neighborhood of 400 people, and started producing instant cameras. What was their reward for that? $635 million judgment by Polaroid. Poor little Polaroid at the time didn't even have a factory that big. Okay? But it's, you know, it was a stupid move. They didn't, and Kodak didn't have enough patents on Polaroid's business. So it was just one of those interesting things that you see that happens. My company now owns the Polaroid portfolio. Just for fun. I know a lot of this stuff. Anyhow, generating revenue through licensing. There are a lot of people who generate revenue through licensing. IBM is rumored to have generated over $1 billion in patent licensing. That's an urban myth. In reality, their patent licensing revenue, true patent royalty revenue on a yearly basis, is somewhere between $100 and $200 million. Trust me, that still buys a lot of cheeseburgers, okay? But it's not $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year comes from all IP-related activity, and they do that in many cases by saying that if they buy a company and they get an influx of value from their patent portfolio and things like that, they count that. If they sell something, they get it. If they write off patents, they do it, and they actually prune quite a bit of patents. So if you read carefully in all their numbers and stuff, the actual royalty bearing is, I think this past year it was about $130 million. Now they are the model though that most people look at for patent licensing. There's a lot of people made a lot from it. Okay, there's some alternates to patents. We got trade secret, which is, you know, the secret recipe for Kentucky Fried Chicken, the Coke formula, those sort of things. Mrs. Fields cookies. Trade dress would be something. Trade dress is a little bit different. It can be something like that, like a design of a can be protected a couple different ways. If you do it with a design patent, it expires in 14 years. So if it becomes something that is recognizable and, you know, is really unique, you can go for trade dress and it gives you basically a lifetime of protection. Maskworks is a little known piece of intellectual property, but Maskworks is a very intensely combated piece of intellectual property in the semiconductor world. Something I know a little bit about because I've worked for companies that made semiconductors. Copyrights, most people understand that. Anybody write a paper this year? Yeah, okay, well, there's copyright rights to that. You don't even have to file for it. Publish, giving to the world, public domain, open source, those are all sorts of intellectual property models that provide a protection framework around intellectual property. Or some sort of, give it some sort of legal basis. So those are, I mean, open space actually, believe it or not, if you take the code and use it, you're agreeing to a contract having to do with the intellectual property rights. So next time you do that, read it. All those click-through things, all that legalese, you'll be writing them someday. Okay, licensing. Licensing, I'll try to get through this pretty easy. Basically, you're producing a license. Somebody's paying money to get access to your patents or exchanging value of some sort, okay? This is sort of a legal definition for it. Let's talk a little bit about what it, you know, some of the common types. You'll hear people talk about different types of licensing. If somebody says they're involved in licensing, it means they are taking licenses with other companies. It's their job to go license technology from others. Out-licensing means that you are involved in selling licenses or getting other people to take licenses. At many places, a person would do both. Okay? I was, when I was at Intel, for the first 5 years I was there, I did all that research and development stuff and a lot of that standards activity and things like that. And I decided that I was really loved inventions. I filed 80 invention disclosures when I was in Intel in those 5 years. 80. You know how many of them they filed? 20. What happened to the other 60? I think they're in a file cabinet in Santa Clara. Okay? What I do know is 22 of those ideas are now, you know, the basis of big businesses. I mean, it's just there. Intel, though, didn't file them because they're not interested in creating $100 million businesses. Really, they're not. If it's not going to be a billion-dollar business getting 50% margin, they're not interested because all it does is erode the expectations of what their stockholders have. And they're not interested in spinning out businesses or funding startups and stuff because they've been really, really unsuccessful in doing that. You know, big executives have been fired from Intel for wasting billions of dollars or bad investments. So they stick to pretty much their core focus, and that's what they do. And they didn't judge it to be enough within their ecosystem. So I was kind of frustrated with that, to be honest. So I said, what they need in the patent group at Intel, they need an engineer that will help them know what they should be doing. And the head of the research lab says, yeah, Greg, why don't you go convince them that they need an engineer? And I said, that's not a bad idea. It took me about a year, and then I was hired into the legal department as an engineer to be the head patent strategist for Intel. And that's how I spent the last 5.5 years of my career there. And I did in-licensing, I did out-licensing, I did cross-licensing, which is very popular in the semiconductor world. I sat on the other side of the table of people that were asserting and so on. I built a team that was 50-something people by the time I left, that's what they did day in and day out. And if you want, only about 20% of them were attorneys, because that was the way that the world is starting to think about patent licensing. patent licensing is no longer a strictly a legal domain. In fact, if you only have lawyers at the table, you're going to miss about two-thirds of what's going on. We talk about it as a three-legged stool. There's a huge technical component. Yes, it's a legal document. It's written in legalese, but it's a technical specification. And the claims are interpreted against technologies and products. And there's a whole business aspect. Lawyers, maybe it's not the way you do it here, but generally I think by your education, by your training, you're taught to use the tools to intimidate people to get what you want. I mean, that's what the laws do. It gives you certain basis for making certain demands and enforcing those demands and so on and so forth. And not saying that that's the way all lawyers behave at all, because I actually work with quite a few lawyers that understand we're getting business done. We're trying to look for the win-win for both sides. But understanding technology, even if you had a good solid undergrad in engineering somewhere, if you didn't go work for 15, 20 years in engineering, chances are you're going to miss a lot of the subtleties of the interpretation there. And unless you've actually done a lot of investment banking or deal negotiation or sales or marketing or whatever, you're going to miss some of the aspects of the business as well. So we always build a three-legged stool, and the lawyer's one of those legs. Technologist is another leg, and a business person is the other leg. And that's what does licensing now. This is the way I built it at Intel, and it's the way it's done now almost every company. It was really interesting because I would do these license negotiations with other companies, and we didn't have attorneys presenting the claim charts. Myself and my colleagues that I brought into the legal department that were engineers, we would present the claim charts. And the business guys sitting on the table, on the other side of the table next to the lawyer, they believed us because we weren't an attorney. And when the attorney started to pick on us or started to challenge us, I could look at him and say, "Don't use stupid lawyer tricks with me. I'm here in good faith trying to help you guys understand the technology." And the business decision maker on the other side of the table would wink at me. He'd say, "Yeah, you get him." And I'm like, "Man, this is so cool." And so... Of course, the lawyers on the other side would walk away from that saying, "Man, I got to get one of those." And that's what's happened now. Throughout Fortune 100 companies, they have engineers working side by side with attorneys running the patent strategy in the patent department. And I think that that's a good phenomenon to occur, because we're starting to see real value being built in the portfolios. The other thing is the investment levels have gotten huge. Okay, anytime you do a patent license, there's other things that can go along with it, be a part of it, and almost always there's some value exchange, but it doesn't have to be money. They can cause joint ventures, research agreements, material transfer agreements, all kinds of things that go along with it. Okay, how many people have heard of the different types of licenses? Okay, exclusive license. The exclusive license means you have all rights to my patent. Basically, I'm giving you exclusive license to it. Okay? You can also sell it, but that's not an exclusive license. If I still want to own the patent and give you all rights to the patent, I give you an exclusive license. Very common in research in universities and so on, because in many cases they still want to retain the ownership, or they believe by statute they must. Okay? Exclusive licenses are very common that way. Partially exclusive means that you can get an exclusive use within a certain scope, and that can be defined all kinds of ways. You can just say you have exclusive use of this patent in the city of Charlottesville. Okay? That means anybody trying to sell in this city, you could bring them up for patent infringement. Now, that would be kind of small compared to the way most of them done, but most of the time it's something like you can use it for entertainment systems on board aircraft. That's a field of use that I've seen. You have exclusive right to use these patents to build those sort of devices. And why do they do that? I mean, why would somebody want to do that? Well, the reason why they want to do it is because it allows you to reduce the cost, because you still have a lot of other rights that you can still enforce. It makes litigation, though, problematic, because There's been several court cases where people have brought suit when they felt like they had an exclusive field of use or something of that nature. And because they didn't have all rights in the patent and they couldn't compel the owner or the people who owned the rest of the rights to join them in the suit, it was determined they didn't have basis. Isn't that interesting? But it's true. So these are becoming less popular now, mainly for that reason. A non-exclusive license is by far and away the most popular form of licensing because this is how it's very different from property. Property, if I have a piece of property and I'm going to garden that property, well, they can't build a building on it because it can only be used for one thing at a time. But a non-exclusive license, you can sell that to 100 people and all 100 of them can make use of it at the same time and be competitors with each other. And so it's very common when somebody is not necessarily commercializing themselves and wants to create a level playing field, that's a very common way of doing it. It's also the most common way whenever companies are doing licensing back and forth with each other. It winds up being resolved as a non-exclusive. People call it freedom to operate. It can also be limited. It could be partially non-exclusive, be limited by field of use. It can include or exclude right to sub-license. Almost never do you actually get the right when you get a sub-license. It's not evident that you have the right to license that then to further people. It's evident if they buy your products that those products are licensed. But if they themselves decide to make those products, they're not licensed. Yeah.
Question. What practical difference is there between a partially exclusive license limited to a field of use and a non-exclusive limited to a field of use? Is there a price differential or what?
Yeah, but it non-exclusive limited to a field of use means that additional licenses can be sold in that same space. Okay? But it means that your product is only licensed when you sell it in that space. Okay? So a partially exclusive that has a field of use means you're only selling one license to one person for making products in that space. So that's the basic difference. The non-exclusive field of use, the partially non-exclusive, very popular when you have a big company dealing with a little company because there's no way in the world usually that the little company can, first off, they don't have a scope of patents the way they do, so it's a way to narrow the price down. What you do is also you say, you can continue to build products in your space, but it also keeps some surety that they're not going to branch out and go into areas to be truly competitive, for example, or at least limits the scope of the competition. It's kind of a subtle thing, and I could give you a lot of examples, but there's some other things. These are common non-licenses that involve basically not suing somebody or putting together legal conditions to keep from suing somebody about patents. One of the most common is a covenant not to sue. Now, what you would see, for example, when we do patent licensing to someone, we go in and we say, we have a stack of patents this big, for example, and this many of them relate to what you built. Okay? The rest of these somewhat can relate to products you either buy from someone else, products you use in the course of making it, or whatever. But since you don't actually create what infringes, we're going to give you a license to this stack, and we promise not to sue you personally, on this stack. Now, what's the benefit of that? It's a pretty interesting benefit. It means that even though they've bought those products and we won't sue them for those products remain unlicensed, which means we can go back and talk to the manufacturers of those products about a license still, because about the sales that they sell to that company, because we've only promised not to sue that company. A covenant not to sue is personal between the two parties, and that's a distinction. It's an important distinction because it also usually something that's a personal promise in a contract doesn't transfer even when the contract transfers. You guys probably, hopefully, have taken that one too. But it winds up being a very interesting way that we look at all the ins and outs. In some cases, they have a provision where they say it must transfer and things like that. But nevertheless, covenant not to sue is a very common non-license that gives someone the feeling of protection without actually impacting the potential for licensing the same way. Litigation standstill, especially in this day and age where people will essentially have the right to DJ you. Do people know what DJ? Who knows what DJ is? Yeah? You do. What is it?
Declaratory judgment. So if they say that they feel threatened that you might bring a lawsuit against them, then they can kind of bring the suit themselves to get the court to declare that, no, they're not going to.
So the it used to be really difficult to get this declaratory judgment, right? It used to be difficult because somebody actually had to be able to prove that they really thought you were going to sue them. Okay? Well, through some recent court cases, this bar has now changed to, if you show them a patent number, they can file a declaratory judgment. You show them anything specific that points them to a specific patent, and even if they don't make a product on it, they can file a declaratory judgment to say that they don't infringe. Now, this is a tactic very often used by the big guys whenever they're talking to the little guys. Okay, why? Because a patent suit costs $2 million. Truly, $2 million, and that's not even getting it all the way to trial yet. Just the filings and so on can be in a tremendous amount of money. So if you're a big company and you've got, 25 lawyers on your staff and, 30 of the best outside counsel, and the other guy, is struggling to stay alive, a declaratory judgment is a way for you to force them into giving you a license. And it's a very common tactic being used. It's a David versus Goliath, but it's the one where Goliath is able to take the sling away. Okay. So what do? Before you talk to them, before you show them patent numbers, you get them agree to a standstill. A standstill is usually a limited period of time, but it usually says, I'm going to show you patents. But these, you promise that these are not providing basis for you to file a declaratory judgment. It's just in the interest of good faith, negotiation, so on and so forth, and you actually get a promise not to do a declaratory judgment for a period of time. In exchange for that, most of the time, you've got to give a CNTS for that same period of time. But there's other things, too. You usually try to get that they're not going to file re-exam on you, they're not going to file interference, they're not going to challenge your patent in a foreign country or anything else. They're not going to do anything to harm your patent position in exchange for you being able to actually have a good discussion. These things are so tough. They're tough to negotiate because, everybody wants to make sure their side's taken care of. It helps when you got a stack of 20,000 patents, though. I will tell you this from personal experience. They will take you very serious, and they will agree to standstills.